All right, so get ready, because today we are going deep on this Georgia Supreme Court case. It's going to make you think about what you thought you knew about this idea of testamentary capacity. We're talking about Wilson versus Lane, and you've given us like a whole stack of legal documents, analyses to kind of, really sort through.
Yeah.
What's our mission? What are we going to uncover on this deep dive today?
Well, we're going to look at what this case can tell us about the line, the sometimes blurry line between someone just being eccentric and actually not having the mental capacity to create a valid will.
Okay.
And what's so interesting about this case is it's not just about some dry legal definition. This is about family dynamics.
Yeah.
Individual rights. And how the law tries to deal with these really complicated issues of human behavior. And we can see all this play out in the story of Jewel Jones Greer and her will from 1997.
Okay, so let's start with Jewel. Like, who was she?
Yeah.
Paint a picture for our listeners. And what was in this will that got everyone so riled up?
Yeah, so picture this woman who is really, really connected to her family. She's got 16 relatives. They're all set to inherit from her. And then there's also Catherine Lane. She's her caregiver.
Okay.
And she is also included in the will. Now, the will on the surface seems pretty simple, right? She divides everything equally among all 17.
Wow.
16 relatives plus the caregiver. You would think that would keep things simple and straightforward.
You would think so, right?
Yeah.
Equal shares, everyone's happy. But I have a feeling that is not what happened.
Well, not quite. So in 2000, one of the beneficiaries, Floyd Wilson, he steps forward and he decides he's going to challenge the will.
Hmm.
He claims that Jewel wasn't of sound mind when she signed that will back in 97. He was saying she lacked testamentary capacity.
Okay, so this is a classic will contest. We've got family members fighting over, what they believe they deserve.
Exactly.
What were the arguments on each side? Like, what kind of evidence do they use to try to prove their case?
Yeah, so it's like we've got these two competing stories, right? The folks supporting the will, they described Jewel as being totally competent.
Right.
They brought in testimony from her friends, even the lawyer who drafted the will, all of them saying she was completely in her right mind when she signed it.
So a pretty strong case for upholding her wishes.
Yeah.
But what about the other side? What did they have to say about that?
The folks challenging the will, we call them the caveaters, they focused on, Jewel's behavior.
Okay.
Described it as eccentric. They argued that these eccentricities were a sign of something more serious, a lack of mental capacity.
So eccentric, what does that mean? What kind of behavior are we talking about here?
So some testimony talked about her fear of flooding.
Okay.
A really intense, maybe irrational fear of flooding.
Mm.
Witnesses also said they were concerned about, things like her hygiene and, was she able to take care of herself?
Mm.
But here's where things get really interesting, okay? They also brought up a guardianship petition that was filed against Jewel in 1998.
Wait, hold on. Guardianship petition. That would be after the will was signed, right?
Right. 97 was the will. 98 was the petition.
Yeah.
So this raises a big question. Does this later event, this petition, mean anything about her capacity back when she made the will?
Ooh. Tricky, tricky. So what did the jury think? Did they buy this argument? That Jewel wasn't mentally sound when she signed the will.
Get ready for a plot twist. The jury actually sided with the caveaters. They decided, yeah, she lacked testamentary capacity.
No way. So that's it. Case closed. Will is invalid.
Not so fast. The legal system had one more trick up its sleeve. The trial court judge, they decided to grant something called a judgment, notwithstanding the verdict. It's also known as a JNOV. It's like the judge hits the undo button.
Wow.
On the jury's decision, essentially saying, look, I disagree with your verdict based on the law.
Hmm.
And they went ahead and validated the will after all.
So the judge overruled the jury. This is getting more and more complicated.
Absolutely. And that JNOV ruling, it means we got to take a closer look at the legal standards for testamentary capacity in Georgia.
Okay, so in plain English, break it down. What does someone have to prove to show that a person didn't have the capacity to make a will?
All right, so think of it like a four-part test.
Okay.
To invalidate a will, you have to prove that the person making the will, we call them the testator, they didn't understand at least one of these things.
Okay.
Number one, that they were making a will.
Okay.
Number two, they didn't understand the nature and extent of their property.
Okay.
Number three, they couldn't identify who their closest family members were, those who would normally inherit.
Okay.
And number four, they couldn't come up with a rational plan for how to distribute their stuff.
Okay. So if you can show that the person was confused about any one of those four things, then the will can be challenged.
Absolutely. But here's the thing. The law actually starts by assuming that people are capable.
Right.
It's called the presumption of capacity.
Interesting. So the person making the will doesn't have to prove that they're capable.
Yeah.
It's on the person challenging the will to prove that they weren't.
Bingo! The burden of proof is on those caveaters.
Okay, so the caveaters, they can't just point to some, personality quirks and call it a day.
Right.
They need hard evidence.
Right.
So
Yeah.
let's talk about the evidence. We've got the witness testimony, the guardianship petition. What else was there?
Well, they also presented medical evidence suggesting that Jewel might have had some dementia. But, and this is a big but, the medical experts never directly connected this possible dementia to her ability to actually make a valid will back in 97 when she signed it.
So just because you have a diagnosis, it doesn't automatically mean you lack legal capacity in the eyes of the court.
Exactly. It's not about slapping a label on someone. It's about understanding how that condition actually affected their ability to make decisions.
Interesting.
And remember that four-pronged test, even with a diagnosis, those caveaters would still need to prove that it actually stopped Jewel from meeting one of those four requirements.
Right.
And that would have to be at the moment she signed.
At that exact moment.
Right.
Okay, so given all of this, why do you think the judge ended up siding with the will and overturning the jury's verdict? What was the reasoning there?
So both the trial court judge and later the Georgia Supreme Court, they zeroed in on that timing of the guardianship petition.
Right, 5 months after she signed. Yeah.
Exactly. They were basically saying, look, there might have been some decline later on, but there's just not enough evidence to prove she lacked capacity back when she actually signed the will.
So they were really focused on that one specific moment, not looking at her mental state overall.
Yeah, and that focus on the exact moment of signing, it kind of highlights a tension in the legal system. We can see it even more when we look at the opinions of the different judges involved.
Ooh, so we have a judicial clash of opinions. I love it when that happens. Tell me more.
All right, so the majority opinion, written by Chief Justice Fletcher, they double down on that strict time focus,
Okay.
saying all that evidence, even the guardianship petition, just wasn't enough to overcome that presumption of capacity.
Right. Burden of proof is on the caveaters.
Exactly. But then you have Justice Carly, who wrote a dissenting opinion. He wanted a more holistic view.
So he wanted to look at the bigger picture.
Exactly. He looked at the medical evidence suggesting dementia, the unusual behavior, the guardianship petition, and he said, all of these pieces together, they show someone whose mental state was declining.
Yeah.
And he thought that decline could reasonably be traced back to the time she made the will.
So two very different ways of looking at the evidence.
For sure. And his dissent brings up some really important questions, like if someone's mental state is declining, how do you pinpoint that exact moment when they lose capacity? Should we even be focusing on a single moment, or should we be looking at a broader pattern?
Those are tough questions,
Yeah.
and it doesn't sound like there's an easy answer.
There isn't. And this debate, it goes way beyond this one case.
Right.
It gets at this tension between individual autonomy, like the right to decide what happens to your stuff, and protecting vulnerable folks who might be taken advantage of.
It's the tricky
For
balance.
sure. And this case shows just how tricky it can be, especially when you're dealing with things like dementia.
Right, which can be so unpredictable. Okay, well, this is giving me a lot to think about. I'm sure our listeners are feeling the same way. But let's shift gears for a minute and talk about some takeaways from this case. Practical stuff, especially for our lawyer listeners who deal with will contests. What are the big lessons they should be learning from Wilson versus Lane?
Well, one of the biggest takeaways is how important it is to have really thorough documentation. Like when you're assessing a client's capacity.
So dotting your I's, crossing your T's,
Yeah.
making sure everything is clear from a legal standpoint.
Exactly. And this is super important when you're creating the will. You need to have a clear record that the client understood all those four things we talked about.
Right. Making the will, what they own, who their heirs are, and why they're choosing to distribute their property the way they are.
Exactly.
So detailed notes from client meetings, recordings of the signing, all of that.
Right. All of that can be super valuable if the will is challenged later on. And another key takeaway is that you need to connect medical evidence directly to those legal standards for capacity.
So not just the diagnosis, but how it impacts their legal capacity.
Right. Just having that dementia diagnosis isn't enough. It's got to be tied to those four parts of the test. And it has to be at the time the will was signed.
It all comes back to that moment.
Okay.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So the medical evidence has to tell a legal story, not just a medical one.
Right. Think of it like building a bridge.
Okay.
You've got the diagnosis on one side.
Yeah.
And you've got the legal definition of capacity on the other. Lawyers need to build that bridge with evidence showing how the diagnosis actually impacts the client's capacity.
So, for example, expert testimony that specifically addresses those four prongs.
Exactly. You need an expert to say, look, because of this diagnosis, the client wouldn't have been able to understand X, Y, or Z when they signed the will. That kind of evidence is super powerful in court.
Okay, this is all incredibly helpful for our listeners. But let's zoom out a bit.
Mm-hmm.
What does this case tell us about how the legal system thinks about mental capacity and these will contests?
Well, I think Wilson versus Lane really shows us that tension between upholding individual autonomy, like the right to do what you want with your property, and protecting vulnerable folks who might be taken advantage of.
It's that balance, right?
It is. And this case really shows how tough it can be to strike that balance.
Yeah, especially with conditions like dementia.
Right, which can be so unpredictable.
It makes you wonder if the law is really equipped to deal with these increasingly complex situations. Like, as we learn more about mental health, as our population ages, will the law be able to keep up?
That's a great question. As we learn more about how our brains work and as we see more elderly folks, the law might need to adapt.
So this brings up a really interesting question. Should courts consider a sliding scale for capacity based on how complicated the estate is? What do you think?
That's a really interesting idea. It recognizes that capacity isn't always black and white.
Yeah.
Maybe a simple will with a few beneficiaries wouldn't need the same level of scrutiny as a complex estate with trusts and tons of heirs.
Right. So, well said. You've given our listeners a lot to think about. I know I'll be thinking about this case for a while.
Yeah, me too.
You know, as we've been talking about this case, it struck me that there's a parallel between what lawyers have to do to prove or disprove testamentary capacity and what we're doing here on this deep dive.
I'm listening. Tell me more.
In Wilson versus Lane, those lawyers had to take all these different pieces of evidence, you know, the testimony, the medical records, the petition, and put them together to make a convincing argument.
Right. And that argument had to be legally sound, meaning it had to address those four parts of the capacity test we talked about.
Exactly. And in a way, that's what we're doing here on the Deep Dive. We're taking legal documents, court opinions, expert analysis, and we're trying to boil it all down to the most important points for our listeners.
I like that analogy. We're like legal storytellers walking our listeners through the twists and turns of the case.
Yeah.
Helping them understand not just what happened, but why it happened.
Exactly. And just like those lawyers, we have to be careful not to let our own opinions influence how we interpret the evidence. We have to be objective, focus on the facts and the law.
Absolutely. It's about presenting a balanced view, showing the strengths and weaknesses of each side's argument, and ultimately letting our listeners decide for themselves.
Well said. And speaking of conclusions, it's time for us to wrap up this deep dive. Any final words of wisdom?
I think Wilson versus Lane is a powerful reminder that estate planning is not something to put off.
Yeah.
You got to have those tough conversations with your loved ones, you know, early on. Make sure your wishes are written down clearly and choose someone you trust to handle your stuff if you can't.
Such an important message. I hope everyone listening is taking notes. Well, thanks for joining me on this deep dive. It's been fascinating.
My pleasure. Until next time.
And to our listeners, thanks for tuning in to the Deep Dive. We'll see you next time for another deep dive into the legal world's most intriguing cases. So just having a diagnosis doesn't automatically mean you lack legal capacity in the eyes of the court. That's a really important distinction.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not about, you know, labeling someone. It's about figuring out, did this condition actually impact their decision making?
Right.
And remember that four-part test, even if there's a medical diagnosis, the people challenging the will would still have to prove that that condition actually prevented Jewel from meeting those requirements.
At the time she signed the will, not before, not after.
Exactly.
Okay, so given all of this, why do you think the judge ultimately sided with the will? Overturn the jury's verdict. What was their reasoning?
So both the trial court judge and then later the Georgia Supreme Court, they really focused on when that guardianship petition was filed. Remember, it was 5 months after she signed the will.
Right.
So they're basically saying, look, yeah, maybe there was some cognitive decline later on, but there just isn't enough to prove she lacked capacity when she actually signed on the dotted line.
So very focused on that specific moment of signing, not a broader view.
Yeah, and that focus on that precise moment, it shows a tension in how the legal system approaches these cases.
Okay.
And you can see this play out even more when you look at the opinions from the different judges.
Ooh, a judicial clash of opinions. I love it when that happens. Tell me everything.
Okay, so the majority opinion, written by Chief Justice Fletcher, they doubled down on that strict time focus.
Okay.
They basically said, look, all that evidence, the eccentricities, the petition, it's just not enough to overcome that presumption of capacity.
Right, right. Yeah. Burden of proof is on the challengers.
Exactly. But then you have Justice Carly. He writes the dissenting opinion.
Okay.
And he wants a more holistic view.
So he's looking at the bigger picture, not just that snapshot in time.
Right. He points to the medical evidence, the unusual behavior that petition filed just a few months later. And he says, taken together, this shows someone whose mental state was declining.
Hmm.
And he felt that decline could reasonably be traced back to the time she made the will.
So two very different ways of approaching the evidence.
For sure. And his dissent raises some important questions, like if someone's mental state is in decline, how do you know exactly when they lose capacity? Should we even be focusing on a single moment, or should we be looking at the whole picture?
These are really tough questions, and it doesn't sound like there's an easy answer.
Not really. It's a debate that goes beyond just this one case.
Right.
It's about individual autonomy, you know, that right to do what you want with your property, but also protecting vulnerable folks.
Trying to find that balance.
Exactly. And this case shows how tricky that can be, especially when you're talking about things like dementia, which can be so unpredictable.
Right, right. Unpredictable. Okay, well, this has definitely given me a lot to think about. I'm sure our listeners are feeling the same way. But before we get too philosophical here, let's talk about some practical stuff. You know, some takeaways from this case, especially for our lawyer listeners, the ones who deal with will contests. What are the big lessons they should be taking away from Wilson versus Lane?
I think one of the biggest ones is how important documentation is. When you're assessing a client's mental capacity, you got to be meticulous.
So making sure everything is super clear from a legal standpoint. Dot your I's, cross your T's.
Exactly. This is especially important when you're actually making the will. You need a clear record that the client understood all those four things we talked about.
Right, right. Making a will, understanding what they own, who would inherit, and how they want to divide things up.
Exactly.
So detailed notes, maybe even recording the signing, things like that.
Right. All of that can be incredibly valuable down the line if the will is challenged. Another takeaway is that you need to connect the medical evidence to the legal standards for capacity. It's not enough to just have a diagnosis.
Okay, so it's not just a diagnosis, but how it impacts their legal ability to make decisions.
Right. A dementia diagnosis alone isn't enough. You need to tie it to those four prongs of the test.
At the moment the will was signed.
Exactly.
Okay, that makes sense. So the medical evidence needs to tell a legal story. Not just a medical one.
Right. Think of it like building a bridge.
Okay.
You got the diagnosis on one side and the legal definition of capacity on the other side. Lawyers need to build that bridge with evidence showing how the diagnosis impacts the client's capacity at the time they sign.
So getting expert testimony that specifically addresses those four prongs.
Exactly. You need an expert who can say, look, this diagnosis would have prevented the client from understanding this or that when they signed. That kind of evidence makes a big difference in court.
Okay. This is all incredibly helpful and insightful advice for our legal listeners. But I want to kind of zoom out for a second. What does this case tell us about how the legal system as a whole thinks about mental capacity and these will contests?
Well, Wilson versus Lane really highlights that tension between individual autonomy, you know, the right to do what you want with your property, and the need to protect vulnerable folks.
It's about finding that right balance.
Exactly. And this case shows how hard that can be, especially when you're dealing with conditions like dementia.
Right. Which can be so, so unpredictable.
Absolutely.
It makes you wonder if the law is even really equipped to deal with these situations. Like, as we learn more about mental health as our population ages, you know, will the law be able to adapt?
That's a really good question. As we understand more about cognitive health and as we have more older folks, the law might need to change.
This raises a really interesting question that I'd love to get your take on. Should courts consider like a sliding scale for capacity based on how complex the estate is? What do you think?
That's a fascinating idea. It kind of acknowledges that capacity isn't always so black and white.
Yeah.
You know, it can be more like a spectrum. And maybe the law should reflect that. Maybe a simple will, with just a few beneficiaries, maybe it wouldn't need the same level of scrutiny as a huge estate with all these trusts and tons of heirs.
Right. It really challenges that idea of one size fits all and asks, does that really work in every case?
It's a question worth thinking about.
It is.
As we learn more about cognitive health, about aging, we got to make sure the law is flexible enough to keep up.
This has been such a thought-provoking conversation. I feel like we've just scratched the surface.
I agree.
But we are, unfortunately, out of time. Any final thoughts you want to leave our listeners with?
I think the big takeaway from Wilson versus Lane is that the law, it tries to be objective, but it often has to deal with these really messy things like human behavior and mental capacity.
Right.
It's a case that makes us ask these really tough questions about autonomy, about vulnerability, and even the limits of legal certainty.
Yeah.
And I think those are questions that deserve to be thought about carefully.
I love that you've given us a lot to chew on today. I know I'm going to be thinking about this one for a while,
Me
right?
too, me too. It really is a powerful example of how the law kind of bumps up against these complicated human experiences.
You know, as we've been kind of unpacking this case, it struck me that there's this interesting parallel between what lawyers have to do to prove or disprove testamentary capacity and what we're doing here on this deep dive.
Oh, interesting. Okay, I'm curious. Tell me more.
Well, you know, in Wilson versus Lane, the lawyers had to take all these different pieces of evidence, the testimony, medical records, the guardianship petition, and they had to weave it all into a story that supported their argument.
Right, and that story had to be legally sound, meaning it had to connect directly to those four parts of the capacity test.
Exactly. And in a way, isn't that kind of what we're doing here on the deep dive? Taking legal documents, court opinions, expert analysis, and trying to break it all down for our listeners.
That's a great analogy. We're kind of like legal storytellers,
Yeah.
helping our listeners follow all the twists and turns of the case, understanding not just what happened, but why.
And just like those lawyers, we have to be really careful not to let our own opinions color how we're interpreting the evidence.
For sure.
We have to be objective and stick to the facts and the law.
Right. Presenting a balanced perspective, showing the strengths and weaknesses of each side, and then letting the listeners make up their own minds.
Well said. Well, speaking of conclusions, it looks like we're at the end of our deep dive today. Any final pearls of wisdom for our listeners?
I think Wilson versus Lane really reminds us that estate planning is not something to put off. Have those hard conversations with your loved ones, make sure your wishes are clear, and choose someone you trust to handle things if you're not able to.
So important. Hopefully everyone's taking notes. Well, thanks so much for joining me on this deep dive. It's been a really interesting journey.
The pleasure was all mine. Until next time.
And to our listeners, thanks for tuning into the deep dive. We'll see you next time for another deep dive into the legal world's most fascinating cases.